We're going to get started. I just want to confirm that you're in the right spot. This is Salon F, and the title for this seminar is Making the Most of What We Have, the Upside Down Learning Model. My name is Harpreet Dhariwal. I'm from the University of Toronto, and I'm the convener for this session. It's a pleasure to introduce the presenters. The first presenter is Dr. Colleen Carmian. She's the Assistant Chancellor for Instructional Technologies for the University of Washington. And in addition to that, she is the Chief Strategist for all of e-learning and innovation for the University of Washington Technology. And to my right is Patricia McGee. She's the Associate Professor from the University of Texas at San Antonio. And in addition to being a professor, she's also the Director of several technology and teaching grants and programs. Fair enough?
Sure.
And Glenda is the e-learning strategist for the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And she's also the e-learning strategist for the University of Illinois. So continue, thank you. And at the end of the session, I'm going to encourage you to do an evaluation for the program. Thank you.
Hello and welcome. We invite our online participants to send us questions. We have a Google Doc we're going to be asking particular online people to contribute, and we're going to capture some of the things that you say today in this Google Doc. We're going to start by talking, framing our model by the three areas that we feel are problematic in higher education, and this kind of supports the solution that we're going to pose. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Morgan to start talking about the very first one.
Okay, I'm going to talk about costs as one of the big challenges that we're facing at the moment. And I have a lot more slides about costs than I have about solutions. I'm always much better about problems than about solutions. In fact, if you have a solution, I have a problem. So, I mean, we all know how big of a problem costs are. Apparently, I need to talk louder or something. Let's put that there. Okay. Is that better? Okay. You know, costs, you know, it's been covered in the news a lot. The costs of college have risen consistently higher than the cost of inflation. And it's hit particularly hard in some states. So, for example, California, where they educate a huge portion of the population, costs went up 21% last year. Arizona and Washington, much, much higher. In some states, that there was a much more modest, like I believe South Carolina was 2.5%, but in general, costs were going up. And it's particularly troubling when you start looking at two-year institutions because they play such a huge role in educating our college-going population, our population in general. Just over 40%, I believe it's 43% of all students in higher education currently are in community college. Costs there went up hugely, though as I was preparing these slides, my grad student pointed out to me that, she went to community college in California and the costs were so low to start with. So you're starting from a very low base there, but still the costs are going up significantly. We're at the risk of losing a lot if we start to drive students out of that population there. If you look at STEM graduates as a whole, and this comes from an NSF report, just over 50% of STEM graduates who got a bachelor's degree in a STEM discipline, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, spend at least some time in a community college. And as you look at Hispanics, at women, and at Native Americans, that proportion goes much higher. So if we start cutting down on access to two-year schools, we're going to have a really big problem. So we all know the story about costs, and I just wanted to sort of lay this out a bit to remind you about the problems of cost and the challenge of cost. But what can we in technology sort of do about it? Just going from some of the Delta Initiative reports, they only have a category for academic support, which includes libraries, IT, all those kinds of things. In general, we take up just a small slice of college budgets. So, you know, we can contain our costs, we can reduce costs in IT or in the library, and that's an admirable thing, but we're not going to have a huge impact on cost overall. So I think we need to stop thinking about cost in the way that we have tended to, in terms of containing cost, reducing cost of IT and stuff like that. We actually have to grow our way out of the problem. We have to find ways that we can actually contribute to the larger purpose of the university and address cost in other ways, like reducing student, increasing student retention, reducing time to degree, those big kinds of things, which is where the costs really can actually have an impact and things like that. But just to illustrate some of the things, I want to do a fun thing. A, because I finally get to show a picture of my nephew. His name is John Luca. He's really cute. But as a sort of conceit, I want to pretend that John Luca is going to go to college next year. Okay, he's not, because he's only three, and he is an advanced kid, but not that advanced. So, you know, as his auntie, his loving auntie, I want him to come to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, where I am. He's from out of state, he lives in Manhattan, so it would cost him approximately 160 grand if you sort of do the math there, because he's paying out of state. And he has a 6 in 10 chance of graduating in 4 years. What if he's a rebel and he wants to stab his aunties in the back and go to Michigan? Okay, we're looking at a lower cost, actually, and a higher chance of graduation. If he goes to Wisconsin to go hang out with Alan there, you know, it's cheaper. Graduation, not so good. His dad went to Purdue, same kind of thing, but he's staying in the Big Ten at least. But his auntie went to Bryn Mawr, and, you know, he's X chromosome challenged, but, you know, just say he wasn't. So what if he went to Bryn Mawr? It's actually cheaper for him to go to Bryn Mawr than it is to go to the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He has a much higher chance of graduating in 4 years. So, you know, I should have picked MIT, but I picked Harvard instead. It's actually way cheaper for him to go to Harvard and a much higher chance. So, I mean, the message I take is that in a public institution, which is where I come from, where I've spent my whole life, we're actually in a bit of a pickle there. We better start addressing cost, and we better start addressing time to degree, retention, and those sort of big kinds of things. So that's my summary of cost there. Colleen's going to talk about engagement.
This one's easy. We've been talking about it for the last 24 hours or so.
10 years. Where do I click?
10 years. The arrow key?
The arrow key. Technology. So the first one is one of the most popular hits for our college students on eHow is how to stay awake during a lecture. Lots of good advice. People participate and share things like you need to suck on candy and lozenges, you need to pinch yourself, you need to doodle. The students are doing everything they can to stay awake because they are not engaged in the lecture. I did some research for EDUCAUSE in the National Learning Initiative a while back on engagement, and there are things that we know. Now, I don't dare call my research analytics because I'm sure people would start throwing things at me from the tenor of the conference so far, but there are things that research has told us about learning and engagement, and a fascinating topic of the last key session, but things that we do know is that learning is engaging and deeper learning is possible when learning is social. The lecture is not. The right side up model that we have right now is not. Learning is engaging, and deeper learning, meaningful learning, happens when learning is active. What we can offer at the kind of costs that Morgan was addressing currently, we don't well model how to make affordable active learning. It's contextual. This certainly, so many stories. So much research on how we are missing the boat on contextual learning. We're missing the boat on, so many of you may know of the Flip the Lecture, got started by a physics professor who realized that his students were getting A's in physics at Stanford, but when asked the simplest questions about physics, they weren't able to answer because they weren't able to put physics into context. They were studying for the test, doing fine, and had no understanding of the world around them. So for it to be meaningful, we have to make it contextual. It requires ownership. And there we're also failing our students. We have no idea how to take the information that we believe we need to communicate to them and to give them the ability to reflect on that, to own it, to make sense of it in their way, and to give it back. And then in terms of engagement, I love this picture. It's a picture that a student took of their own TA. It's not even engaging for the person in the front of the room. So we certainly have to think about how we can affordably change what we're doing to address the students that we have in higher education right now, and even the TAs that we have in higher education right now. Okay, next one.
Okay, so I'm going to address the challenges of the technology impact. And what I have seen in my research is that, of course, we know that technology is still disruptive after all of this time. After our using it, spending a lot of money for it, students are bringing it to class. We have the tools, they're free and open, but how much do we use them to really support learning? We focus on satisfaction typically in our assessments or evaluation. We still are kind of disconnected in how we're assessing and thinking about the impact of technology. And I'll explain that further in a minute. It's the data that we collect is often fragmented or doesn't really mean anything to inform us about how we should or could be better finding out the impact. And we don't capture informal learning. To me, this is kind of the biggest challenge, particularly as we shift into blended and mobile learning, where everybody has their own device, but there's no centralized way to see and collect and observe and measure what's really happening outside of the formal environment. But we do know that learners are enmeshed and immersed with tech, then they use it for their own purposes. I mean, students use things that we give them in different ways than we had intended them. Impact, I think, is more than achievement and satisfaction, however. And I guess my question is, how does tech relate to educational outcomes and meaningful, relevant, authentic, and utilitarian purposes that really students come to college for? And I read an article this week about the MAO of human behavior. It's a model, the MAO model of human behavior. And the author, the researcher, is arguing that, using this kind of metaphor, that we tend to look at things in isolation of each other. In this picture, the writer represents this intentional piece of this environment with rationality, making rational decisions about where they go and how they go. The elephant, however, has habits processed that are learned over time and yet very sensitive to the environment represented by the jungle around it, which provides stimulus both to the writer as well as barriers and distractions, and it can be modified by both the elephant and the writer. So for me, this kind of represents how complicated using technology is in an environmental where we have a vehicle, and yet we are typically heading down one route. And I love this picture, the elephant in the middle of the living room that we can't see, because we tend to just focus on the end user using the tool, as opposed to everything that's going around us, and that makes it invisible to us as we're trying to capture what the impact might be. So those are our three challenges that we feel, and what we want to know for you and the audience online as well, what have we missed? What other pressing challenges are there out there that we should be addressing as we're thinking about models for 21st century learning? Or have we covered it all?
I would say faculty motivation.
A great and Let's stay an extra hour to talk about that one. Because indeed, I mean, part of the problem with a changing model is how do we adapt to change, and where are the incentives, where are the motivation, how do we make those explicit? Anyone else want to add something to the description, the Venn there, of what the current model looks like with seat time, course evaluations, and lecture? Then let's hop into aspects of a new model. She wants to talk more about that old broken model. So we have a Venn diagram here of some of the problems that worked in the industrial age that we're struggling with now. When we were educating for a small population, a self-chosen small population, grades based on seat time, course evaluations of students who were already overprepared by the time they got to college, and the lecture format. That was sort of our description of what the current model looks like. The three of us have strong interests in solutions that we believe are possible and affordable in a model that you turn upside down and take away out of the lecture format, out of the seat time and the credits by course. And each of us are going to take a piece of that and talk about blended learning, analytics, and the move to mobile and cloud.
Yeah, and part of what we're kind of arguing here is that in the old model, you know, college was for the few. Not everybody went to college. 21st century, college is for all. Everybody's going to college. One thing I've seen as an academic over the many years I've been there is that we build all these supports into the system for the students who aren't prepared to go to college. And we know that the research says that something like, I don't know, 60% of all undergraduates do not go into the field that they have been trained to or prepared to go into. So that college degree, I mean, there's kind of a disconnect between I'm going to college so I can go get a job, but I don't take the job that I have been prepared for. So this is an interesting situation for us, particularly thinking that we have a broader range of people who come to college for different purposes. So Glenda's going to address our first component of our model, which is the mobile and the cloud.
Okay. I was in mid-tweet, appropriately, with somebody else in the room. So mobility. So any of you remember an article that Brad Wheeler wrote in an EDUCAUSE population a few years ago where he said, you know, we've got to stop talking about e-commerce. It's just commerce now. Brad Wheeler's a smart guy, so I'm going to make a similar claim. Please can we not talk about m-learning? I hate the phrase m-learning. Learning is learning, and we use mobility, but it's not m-learning. And I know I'm called an e-learning strategist, but I didn't make that up. I'm a university administrator. So mobility in the cloud. Actually, I need my notes. Going with text-like slides is all very well, except that you forget what you're going to say. So why mobility, and why is it not important, and why is it not m-learning? There is something different about using mobile devices. For a couple of things. One is it changes our relationship with the technology. And it took me a long time to see it. We've got two pictures here, somebody using a desktop, somebody using a laptop. Your relationship with those kinds of things changes. One is very fixed, the other one is much more flexible. You can take things, but it means you use it in different ways, you do some different kinds of things. Once you move into the mobile, that really, really changes. You know, you really have a different interaction with the technology. But it changes your relationship with the technology, but it also particularly changes your relationship with content. And if you think about it, think about the ways that you relate with content and the ways that it has changed with things like with phones, with iPads and things like that.
One thing is that people do it more. They like it more. It gives them a greater sense of control or something like that. You know, we're looking things up. It's much more engaging. And we still need to scaffold activities around that. But there's something there about interacting with mobile content. The second thing is that mobility enables the social. You know, without mobility, there is no social. I mean, or in a very, very limited way. Things like Twitter, like Facebook, like things like that. And we haven't really harnessed that in fully for teaching and learning, but we need to. Theorists like Alexander Aston, Paul Light, people like that have written a lot about the importance of social and learning, and we really need to harness that. Another big thing is user-generated content and learning across different kinds of contexts. All this really, really changes. So it really sort of unleashes things there. Oh, sorry, I got ahead of myself. But one thing is that we need to think about mobility in relation also to the cloud. I remember a few years ago when I was working in the CSU, I was involved a little bit in a project that Fresno State was doing where they were giving students in high schools, in low-income high schools, laptops to use. And so I was doing some interviews with these students, and they were saying the laptop is great, but it doesn't come with a subscription to the internet. So I have a car, but I have no gas. It's the same with mobile and the cloud. You've got a car, but no gas, because you need to be able to move your content around. So mobility has to be part of the solution. And I'm scared, because Colleen said if I talk too long, she was going to smash my kneecap. So
Blended. I'm actually doing a series of studies in Blended. I finished one. I'm just writing up two. The first one was analyzing best practices, effective practices. And I collected over 60 different guides for how to do blended learning. I'm doing another one on the pedagogy of blended learning, and a third one on the models of blended learning. And, you know, kind of this emerging understanding, and plus I use blended learning in my own work, but part of my understanding of this is that it's untethering us from campus, from location, from the things that used to tie us down and limit what we do. And I'm hearing that in this conference, too, about what's being reported, is that it's allowing us to operate and walk in the world in different ways through technology. And yet it's still challenging to think about how it works. And I have some thoughts about the faculty issue. But before we go there, I wanted to kind of speak about how Blended addresses some of the challenges that we posed in the beginning. For me, particularly, I see Blended offering more options and flexibility. When I got into distance learning, the whole idea was, isn't it great? We can learn anytime, anywhere. And yet, having gone through many institutional trainings of online providers, one of the first things they teach you is get online every day at the same time. You have a synchronous event. And that seems to kind of be contradictory about the vision and the potential power of it. Well, Blended allows us some of these options and flexibility. I think it also can, well, by report anyway, institutional reports, results in higher levels of satisfaction for some, which then, you know, in theory, results in higher levels of engagement. Is it just for convenience, or is it because I'm more engaged with the content? I think that kind of remains to be seen. It can allow for more cross offerings because we're reconfiguring classroom spaces. I don't know how many of your campuses do this, but on our campus, we have to kind of submit a form and then negotiate with those who are teaching at the same time, how can we divide that classroom space up in one room? So that's one of the benefits. Then we also know that it can increase ways for students to participate. For instance, English second language learners, caregivers, workers, all these non-traditional students that we supposedly increasingly, first-time college students in my campus, allow them to participate in different ways, hopefully addressing some of the affordability costs that Glenda mentioned, because we're giving them ways not just to save that cash dollar, but also how to use their time in ways that are more that raise the value of investment for them. Then we also, this is pretty clearly documented in the literature, that Blended learning triggers some pedagogical shifts. typically more learner-centered, and using a variety of technologies. Maybe sometimes too many, maybe sometimes not enough. However, that is something that we see happening in the literature. And finally, we see that blended learning facilitates and, of course, requires learning outside the classroom, which is something I've heard over and over in the sessions here. How can we use strategies that allow the learner to learn on their own when they want to, and when it's relevant, convenient, acceptable to them? Not just you have to be here right now and do this. And we see, of course, a lot of tools that have developed over time, services, open courses, all the new textbooks initiatives where things are free or we can modify, we can get expert information. All kinds of things are open that support this. We see it happening. And we even have organizations offering, helping faculty and teachers figure out how to do this kind of blend. I mean, this is an organization that goes out and teaches people how to do it, how not to do it, how it works. In my mind, I think that our model has already exists, but it's like that elephant in the middle of the living room. We're not really consciously acknowledging it or strategically planning around the model. And that makes it real rocky, and I think that addresses some of the questions about faculty development, is that until it is a visible elephant in the middle of the living room, I'm not sure that we can do too much more. So Colleen's going to address the remaining parts of our challenges through a discussion on analytics, which you've been hearing quite a bit about in this conference.
I must work in some isolation at my university because I didn't even know that analytics was an incendiary topic until I got here yesterday. And I thought this was going to be the easy part of the triangle there, because I really think that when we're talking about a changing population, a changing generation, a college-going group that we found out here, 80% of our college students now hold down full-time jobs. These are not the people that we were when we went to school, and we need to treat them differently. We need to find support structures for them. We need to make learning available to them, the hours that they have to come to the learning experience. And I believe analytics is a game changer because I think it can do that. It can provide smart machine pattern recognition, smart machine nudges, support, awareness that we didn't even have the ability to see before we could use big data analysis of that material. And we are just scraping an understanding of the way it can reach out to students. And it's really great that John Campbell is here at this session. He's a good person to talk to if you see him in the halls, because Purdue did really nice work with their Green Light program, where they're able to look into the LMS data and send notices to students on a daily basis with a green, yellow, and red light as to how they are doing in terms of coming to the online experience, in turning in their work, in logging in accessing the material, and to give them feedback based on a history of how well students did previously in that same kind of experience. And it was pointed out yesterday, well, yes, that's correlation and not causation, so is it really that helpful? Correlation is helpful. It is how we begin to understand problems in an intellectual inquiry. So it's the beginning of possibility of the machine and the student having a relationship based on what that student is doing in the moment. And it is not cost ineffective to start to begin to do this kind of work. And I think that's a really important point that we have been looking at here, is what can we afford? And I would make the case that based on the amount of money that Didi has been given by the NSF to put together little 1 and 2 hour tutorial animation worlds, we can't afford to do that for very many of our students. But we can afford to do the sweeping patterns and give every student the kind of individualized feedback that may make a difference to their success or not. Discuss.
Okay. So at this point, we wanted to see what you think about our model and how you would comment on it or add to it or give illustrations for it or tear it apart. Or most of you got a piece of chocolate, so be nice. But what things do you have that you would like to say about, or questions you have for us? Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm all done.
I'll just sit down here. I'll just do this. Here we go. I'll say this in my analysis of the literature, and blended particularly, it's fascinating to me how that tends to be a recommendation. But along with that also is that it's segmented, and that you give students different ways to get through content, so that when you meet in the classroom, you're actually doing the processing or clarifying misunderstandings, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're shifting away from that, as Didi illustrated too today, that there are really pedagogical solutions here, that the delivery of content is very, is very tricky. Some of us could probably listen. I was fortunate in one of my earlier careers for an interactive television network to work with Tony Gregoric, who is a mind styles theorist, and he could deliver 6 hours of streaming live video of him lecturing, and people would pay attention only because he really understood how people's minds work. Most of us don't understand that. So I would argue that, yes, what would have to happen, particularly with the mobile technologies and being out of the classroom, it isn't about delivering 3 hours of content. The other tricky thing, though, related to that is how institutions measure contact time. And some institutions really do see that 3 hour or 1 hour streaming video as part of contacts. And that's kind of the infrastructure policy part that's a part of that elephant in the middle of the living room that we may or may not be addressing.
Anybody else?
Yes.
And I have one piece to add to that. The old model, we addressed seat time. And in the new model, it is exciting, the universities that are trying to explore the possibility of tossing out seat time. Now, to some degree, that almost happens with online learning without acknowledging it. You still get 3 credits, but how are we measuring seat time? But there are some interesting experiments happening where it's performance-based instead of seat time, and it doesn't matter if it took you 80 hours that week to do it. And we see great experiments with this with the Khan Academy. You know, I loved that slide we saw yesterday. Yes, we can. You know, students are allowed to watch those videos over and over, and a student that can rapidly go through can get the credit in 3 weeks, a student that takes longer. So online gives us a lot of affordance that we couldn't even find in the classroom. Before we go on, there is a Google Doc that's open for people to put their comments and work into. And if you want to bring it up and show people, because that's our last slide, please feel free to add reflections, questions, pieces into the Google Doc.
Sorry, could I actually answer that?
Yeah, I was going to.
And actually, so I'm involved in a research project with Alan Wolf and Chuck and Patsy, Chuck Zubin and Patsy Moskal and a couple of other people looking at how students use digital resources. And I was expecting to find students not that enthusiastic. And I remember I was sitting in the conference room in DCL where Al, who asked the question, used to work, and I nearly fell off my chair the first time this came up, but it's come up consistently since then. Students are reporting that when they're having problems, you know, they're in a class with, you know, a calculus class, somebody isn't explaining the concept, literally they're putting their headphones in their ears and they're going online to find stuff. And often it's chunked stuff, so it's small little bits, but sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's actually a whole lecture. But they tend to prefer it from Stanford and MIT or wherever, rather than the Khan Academy, actually. That's what I'm hearing. And I was happy to hear that, because I'm actually not a fan of the Khan Academy, for a whole bunch of reasons. I think there is still a capacity for the lecture, but we'll have to sort of tease that out in the data.
Hi, I'd just like to support what Colleen was talking about and maybe try and answer your questions about online versus a live lecture. So we've been piloting this last couple of terms, and this is the sort of the knowledge I want to share with you and to emphasize the flexibility. So what students are able to do in an online lecture versus a live lecture is if they don't understand something, they can go back and watch it again at that instant, and they can pause it and let it sink in. So pedagogically, that makes great sense. They can do that. But what we're finding is the software for some of these lecture capture appliances or devices allows you to, and the word for this conference is the analytics, is you can actually see the group of students that watched one section of a lecture over and over again. And that's great information for the professor to say either he's not teaching that well or it's a genuinely difficult topic that requires an entire lecture and not just 10 minutes, because he's seeing the majority of the class go and watch that 10 minutes of the lecture over and over again. So I think that's sort of where the flexibility and the benefit of online lectures versus live lecture can come. I don't know if that helps answer your question, but okay, thanks.
Other questions?
Comments?
Case studies?
I think we also need to think about environment, and this is, I'm thinking about this a lot as I'm sitting here, because we've all been through the thing of writing a conference proposal, and they really don't want you to just stand up here and talk for an hour. And so you have to say how you're going to do it interactively, but then they put you in a room like this where you're on a dais and people are in these deadly rows of chairs. And it's really hard to do anything else, as we've just discovered. So, you know, I think we need to create environments where other things can do. So we have to think of things like what classrooms look like, how they are structured, things like that. So
one of the things that I think is missed, a lot of us as faculty, and I'm also an instructional designer, we miss when we try to take the idea of a lecture from the classroom online, we forget that the lecture in the class is not simply the words coming from the professor. It's the reading of the faces of the students. It's the questions coming back. And so it's not a 60-minute presentation that's got to be captured online, but it's instead trying to recapture or reframe that entire interaction. And I wonder if y'all have some suggestions on how to encourage faculty to think that way so that they can break it up with little, not only getting that feedback like the replays or whatever, but also breaking that activity up, the lecture up with activities, quizzes, go out and find this, that, or what have you.
Yeah, I know, I just off the top of my head, yeah, things that I've found to be effective and have seen others do. One is embedding in the presentation either points of query so that they know, and I'm thinking, my blended hat on, that that you may be delivering a lecture, then you pose a question, and they know when they come to class, they're going to be prepared to answer that question or respond or have some data to support whatever it is that they've processed. I do like slide rockets. I also do voice threads and things like that. But it's always about them having to come to class to bring something that was an outcome of that lecture, or not really a lecture, whatever the activity was. And I find that that helps them be more engaged. But I also like the idea, yeah, of shortening or having a way to have students add comments. I really do like VoiceThread and the different PowerPoint presentation tools where people can have threaded discussions along with it. There are some services now that even you can embed live, active, self-initiated assessments, matching, fill in the blank, or whatever, that becomes a part of the presentation. I'm not talking building something out of flash animation by yourself, but that is expanding the capacity so the learner can self-assess that formative learning that Dee Dee was talking about being much more powerful than the summative. I think that's a very cool and engaging thing. Did I get it? I'm going to go take a test. Oh, no, I didn't. Okay, I better go back and look at it again. I think those are the kinds of things that are going to be very helpful.
I have two sort of story case studies to share to answer that question. I have become obsessed in the last few weeks with Live Mocha. Has anyone else been in Live Mocha? Just to experiment, it's free, so just to experiment with what it is like to do independent learning and depend on your peers, go in and start learning a new language. Live Mocha puts up excellent audio and visual learning materials for you in nice small chunks. You then do an assessment, and native speakers from all over the world grade your responses. And you become friends with them. And I hate being at this conference in a way because I've been busy 15 hours and I have friends waiting for me to grade their audio files and their papers. And they depend on me and I want to get back to them as quickly as possible. It's almost addictive learning. So there's a sort of one example of a new model that doesn't depend on an expert. In a sense, the experts are the native speakers that are helping me in correcting the way I speak and the way I do things. And the second one is this very conference. I said to Morgan an hour or so ago, "What did I do at conferences before Twitter?" Because I'm learning as much from everyone in the audience when I'm in a session as I am from the person on the front of the stage. It's very participatory learning. And you don't, I'm bonding with a whole lot of people here, and I don't even know what they look like. You know, I'm passing them in the hall, and I don't realize that we've been having sort of deep exchanges on Twitter. So there's another example where I don't see a person's face, but I'm getting so much learning out of that engagement.
Yeah, other questions, comments?
I wanted to add one thing.
Okay, we have a question.
The biggest problem, as far as I'm concerned, the model's great. I think everybody gets that this is the way students want to learn, that focusing on student learning outcomes is the right thing. Students want to learn this way. I think everybody gets that. So I send emails to my faculty saying, oh, this MITx class, maybe you could use some of that in your course. And what they fire back after a couple of emails, because they have to talk to me, right, because I'm the vice chancellor, so they have to respond rather than go, idiot, which they might be saying to themselves, but they don't say on their email. What they eventually say is, what's my value add in the class anymore? And you can hear that crisis voice, which is like the piece in The Atlantic that basically says, there's not going to be tenure anymore. A whole lot of tenured people are going to be out of work. So faculty aren't stupid. They see that this is where this may go. So yes, it's a great idea, and yes, there isn't a faculty person who wouldn't subscribe to the idea that student learning is really important, and if we can improve student learning, we're all on board. But if they see at the other end of this, I'm losing my job, or I have to radically change the job that I have, we have a major obstacle to overcome. Do you have any suggestions?
She'll have more to say than I do, but as a faculty member, I'm not going to let her say it, but I just think two things. One thing is, I think our roles are going to be repurposed, quite frankly, as a faculty member. I see that more and more as a mentor and a guide and somebody that, you know, I don't quite know how that will work, but I know in my many years of higher ed, I've seen that happen in my role. I'm not in charge. I teach everybody from freshmen to graduate students, and usually in the same semester. And it's a real, makes my head spin sometimes. Because those freshmen, man, I'm telling you, they're something else. They're fascinating. And here's my motivation for change, and I think this is true of a lot of people. I see this because of the levels of frustration trying to teach the old model way. It's clear, I can't say this, maybe some of you know this research, but it seems to me like there's more of a relationship between cheating, disengagement, absenteeism, et cetera, when we're still trying to follow the 20th century model. I think it is a pedagogical shift that's going to solve some of the challenges. But I really, and the other thing, just one more thing, and then I'll shut up, is that I think there needs to be, for faculty, there needs to be more push. There's an awful lot of pull. We're switching Blackboard systems. I don't know if it's from my institution in this room, but we're switching systems, upgrading. And to help us, to have us figure out, learn how to use it, we're just going to have tons of, workshops that we're going to have to go to. They're going to offer more. It's like, I don't want to go to a workshop. Come. We have a model in my department where every month we invite somebody from IT to come sit with us for 15 to 20 minutes and teach us something. Every month we learn something new. It doesn't take a lot out of a faculty meeting. But it's great. We have to be there anyway. I was resistant at first, but now I'm kind of looking forward to it. And that's how we're going to learn the new version of Blackboard. We're not going to any workshops. So, Morgan.
I think change for humans is very, very difficult, regardless of who they are. And I think we pick on faculty sometimes. But I remember about a year ago sitting in a meeting at my university. It's something we call caffeine break. We have them every week, and what are called IT pros, people who work in IT, come there. And we were talking about an endpoint management system that we were going to be implementing. We're actually implementing two. And one of the IT pros said, but if you implement this, what will I do in my job? My job is going to go away. And it's like, no, but you'll have, somebody said, how much do you work currently? And he's working 14, 15 hours a day. And it's like, you'll learn to do better value-added kinds of things. But I think the challenge that you raised is just a huge one, and we do need to sort of try and do that. I used to joke when I actually did more work with faculty in terms of things. I used to say, I don't want your project. I don't want your whatever thing I'm funding you to do. This is the Jesuit model. I want your soul. I think we need to change people's souls so that they want something different. But in terms of the solution, as I try and think about how to do that, because I think we have a huge one, I think actually of something that I went through at the Fry Leadership Forum, and a bunch of my Fry classmates are in the room. One of the coolest things we did, and the Fry program has done away with this exercise, I believe, which is not an inspired move. So one of the things we did was we actually had to do a budget exercise. So we had a CFO from a college come. We got put into groups, and we had to design a university from the ground up and make, using the budget model with a spreadsheet and everything, we needed to break even in 5 years. And I learned more about budgeting in those two horrendous weeks, having to sit in a room with Gail Persily over there and balance the budget. But it gave me a sort of much bigger view of things, and I think we need to find an analogous kind of thing with faculty to see that, yeah, your future is tied up in this, and there's a new way of doing things, and it's not about making you redundant, it's about finding where your value added is. Because we've all sat in things that were awful and things that were excellent, and there's a difference there. And what faculty do is provide that scaffolding and that teaching, but we need to find new ways of doing it. Just one last point is, it's a model for a system, because I think they need to go together. I think there's a danger in looking at things in bits. So we have sessions on blended learning, We have sessions on mobile. We have sessions on analytics. But they need to be considered as a system and as an ecology. And only then do I think we find the way out of some of the problems that we laid out.
I think I want to repeat what Morgan said in a slightly different way for myself, and that is every other industry on the globe is changing right now, and ours has to as well. And we are the one institution that has resisted most strongly. So one of the answers is to just look faculty in the eye and say, if you are not tenured, change or die. And if you are tenured, change or be very unhappy, because your students in the classroom are unhappy. But it goes back to that first question that was asked, is do we have good ideas in place right now for motivation of change, which is hard. And so does anyone in the room, are you doing anything at your institution that you could call successful?
I don't know if I would call it successful. I'm a dean at a brand new community college. And I have essentially told my faculty that we are in the digital age. We have digital learners, and they need to get on board. I have told them that I have said it in a nice way, but basically I just said, you know, if you're not here to do something different and more dramatic in terms of successful student learning, then you need to leave. You need to either retire, get another job, or what have you, because this is serious business, and we are not here to do business as usual. And so those may seem very tough words, but we are in D.C. We have students who are first generation. A lot of them are low income. And so we have to be very different in terms of how we approach them. However, with our students, they get in the elevators. What do they have? They have their phones. They have their earbuds. They're connected all the time. And so we have to meet them where they are. And even our CEO has said that we have to unlearn how we learned and get better connected to our students. And so I'm sensing a shift in terms of how the faculty are thinking about, well, what am I really doing in my classroom? And how can I be doing this better? And it's not about me, it's about them. And so that's not the best case scenario in terms of success. I just think that we need to talk more tougher with our faculty. I have great faculty, but some of them need to either grow or go, and that's what we're dealing with.
I think there's another one here that wanted to share. Just, yeah, raise your hand again. I moderate your system. One other thing I wanted to say that Didi said this morning that I think is important is that most of us haven't learned the way that we're talking about students should learn. So can we afford opportunities for faculty to learn in those ways so that they have an inside perspective and find it satisfying or gratifying themselves, and maybe that would help. I don't know. Share your great work.
I just have to disagree a little bit with kind of the hardcore approach, and that's because I went there. We're leading a blended learning initiative, and one of the department chairs, who was one of my former professors, was so upset by what she heard me saying, which was really just, this is a potentially better way for students to learn, that she actually swore at me. And, you know, we've since reconciled, but when I stopped to hear the fear that she was expressing, and then I just stopped and honored what she had taught me in the way that she had taught me, then it was like all of a sudden the walls came down, and while she hasn't joined our initiative, she allowed two instructors under her in her department to join. So I think there's a real balance to say, you know, you either do it this way or you leave. I think personally students are going to self-select. I think they're going to say, I like this blended learning model, and that's exactly what we've seen at our institution. But I think we need to be cautious to honor them and to realize diffusion of innovations, not everyone's going to get on board. And I think we need to let them have the freedom to fail if they want, while we're out there being the innovators saying, here's a better way to do it, let's get on board with this. Not everyone's going to. So I think still being respectful will actually help to bring those people on board.
It's interesting that you talk about failure, because we've been talking about that too. Why aren't we sharing the failures and not just the successes? There's actually a conference on failure that you go and share your failures with everybody, and that's kind of the focus rather than what you're successful at.
I think I might even go a step further in honoring what people are at and letting them be where they're at. If you are, and I think this goes back to what the faculty role becomes. I've got a faculty member who has told me he doesn't want to give any more lectures that he wouldn't want taped and on YouTube. If he can't give the best lecture on that piece of chemistry, he wants to find another way to deliver that content. And he wants to spend his time doing what he does think he's an expert at. And to a certain extent, I think that in a blended environment for many of our institutions, if you have an expert lecturer or an expert, you know, classroom discussion leader, what we need to find perhaps is a way for them to spend more of their time doing that and find a way to outsource the quiz writing or whatever other part of their time is keeping them from honing a really beautiful lecture on a topic.
So I want to kind of take the discussion towards more of the student's role. I'm working with faculty right now, and my primary role at the university is working with faculty to implement a lot of these new technologies. And so I've got three faculty members in particular who have gone above and beyond the expectations that I had, and they are telling me that I have a group of students within my class that are saying, why are you making me do this? In other words, why are you making me think? I just want to sit here. I want you to just give me the answers, and I want you to just give me the test so I can finish this course. And so I think one part of that model needs to be, you know, what about the students on the other side of that? How do we encourage the expectations from them for their own learning as well? And I think because the model that we've had for so long has been about this passive learning, that we've got students now who just expect the passive learning and not necessarily the engagement that we are all trying to employ.
For me, that part of that is relating it to their goals and what they're supposed to be able to do when they leave the institution. That's something we've talked about quite a bit in the last 24 hours, is that, you know, are we preparing them for a vocation? Are we preparing them for another degree? What do they see to be valuable, authentic, relevant, meaningful? And I think that we can get caught up in the activity of learning, and lose sight of what motivates them and helps them go forth into the world feeling like they're capable and able.
I'm going to quickly say the answer is almost the same as what we've been hearing for the faculty, right? And someone wrote on here in terms of that question of honor the fear and do it. Honor the fear and do it anyway. And it would be the same for the students, isn't it? Honor their fear, but as Patricia says, we are asking them to step into this collaborative, digital, consensus-seeking, own the material, come to the task. We're asking them to do this because that's the world they're going to have to face, and they're going to have those skills. So the skills that we're giving them of sitting, facing us, and writing down what we say, when are they going to use those in the world? So that's what we tell them. And we've got one more here.
Yeah, just a quick comment in terms of what's the role of administrator in this process? Because so far we spoke about faculty, student, but we know also that most successful technology initiatives actually are driven when you have very wise and forward-thinking senior leadership.
Patricia had an answer for that the other night. I had gotten an email from my vice chancellor asking how to move forward on an agenda that faculty would not necessarily be pleased with, and Patricia told us that we should together read Daniel Pink's book, Drive, and then JW and I discuss it and take apart the pieces that explain how the human mind works in terms of motivating, getting over fear, giving people the will and the drive and the interest to do something. Maybe all of us should read Daniel Pink's Drive and then open a Google Doc or a Wiki and come up with solutions for how administrators move forward, how faculty move, how
Colleen,
students.
We have one more question back there, and then we need to wrap.
I was just going to make a quick comment. Clay Shirky does a lot of work on collaboration versus institutions, and he makes a, he's got a TED Talk I'd highly recommend if you just search Clay Shirky and on TED. But one of his points is that an institution, even though you have a stated mission of what the institution is, really the ONSCOD, the primary mission of an institution is to preserve itself. And so this is what we have happening, is the self-preservation comes before anything. And one of the things he mentions jokingly, but I think it's very apropos, is the Kubler-Ross method of when somebody's dealing with a terminal disease, and you go through all these stages. And of course, denial is the very first stage that we hit. So, you know, maybe by being able to use that framework of, you know, and I know it's oversimplified and blah, 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 but, you know, you want to start getting to the bargaining stage at some point.
Okay, I'm going to ask to wrap up, if you mind, because it's 12:30.
Sure.
So just before you go, I'll just come up here and make my last. So thank you. Do you have any final comments?
No, thank you all for coming and staying, and happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you for everyone for coming. I'd like to... I'd like to encourage you to do an evaluation form. Thank you for an exciting talk. I felt like Phil Donahue dating myself for walking around, but thanks.